of uranium. It has gold. It also, I learned from Chandra Muzaffar of Global Research, it's sitting atop some of the largest aquifers in all of Africa. So is Niger another case often found in the global south of rich country, poor people?
You'll remember that in the last 7-8 years of his life, Muammar Gaddafi was trying to tap a giant aquifer that was there in the southeast of Libya, an underground lake. He was trying to build this massive lake project and so on. He's very moved to try to bring the water to the cities. And so this question of water is important. In many cases, as Mahmoud Mamdani had argued about Darfur, many cases, the war in Darfur was around water because of the desiccation of the Sahel, Sahara coming south. A question of water is paramount here. But I think there's something else there when the New York Times says what it says. You see, they used to always say Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda. But interesting, this is not credible anymore. Now the credibility is Russia, Wagner Group. It's true. For many years, when these militaries found that the French were not able to defeat the insurgencies in their countries, they turned for help to various groups, including Wagner. But ever since Wagner's implosion, you know, around the Ukraine war and that dispute between Prigozhin and Putin, ever since that, Wagner has not actually been such a major force in the Sahel region. You haven't seen the Russians as prominently as one had for a time. It's not that they were not there. They are there even in Libya. But since the Prigozhin-Putin issue, Wagner has not really been playing a big role. So very interesting, in my opinion, is that the Russians aren't such a big source of what's going on here. Now, it could be that Russia will take advantage of this. Certainly, that is possible. It could be other forces will take advantage of this. I must say, I'm not surprised that the New York Times is unwilling to actually note that the people of Niger might have their own agenda, that they don't have to move from one puppet master to the other. You know, from being under the thumb of the French and the US to another thumb, you know, under the thumb of the Russians. Why can't you imagine that they want to have their own agenda? And in fact, it's interesting. When the issue of the military interventions was being discussed, on the table was the question from Mali and Burkina Faso saying that if you invade Niger, we are coming for you. We are also going to enter this conflict. There was no word from the Russians or from the Wagner group. This is the people of the Sahel sticking together. It's interesting that the New York Times simply doesn't see this. It instead just can't see the people of Niger as being in a way sovereign.
Iqbal Ahmed, the legendary Pakistani intellectual activist, deplored what he called the pathology of power. That is to say, post-colonial states ruled by Western educated elites, brown and black faces in high places with a strong military. So you can have your veneer of independence, you know, you could have your postage stamps, your anthems, your flags, even streets named after some of your heroes. But when it comes to real independence, the sovereignty is not there. It rests in Washington, London, and Paris.
You know, Franz Fanon called this flag independence. There's a bitterness to these critiques. You know, there's a bitterness because there was so much expected of freedom movements. But in a way, in many countries, they had to make a deal prematurely. You know, in India, Pakistan, in the Sahel region, they made a deal with the French. You know, they said, okay, go now and we'll make some economic adjustments for you. In India, British go now, but we're going to protect British capital in India for some time. You know, these deals prevented maybe bloodshed. You know, maybe India would have gone the way of Malaysia or Kenya, you know, massive bloodshed, armed struggle and so on. Maybe that would have won some more sovereignty. I don't know. But the fact is that there was a compromise made with the colonial elites, with the neo-colonial structures in the world. I'm not going to judge the compromise. That's a fact of history. That's why there's a bitterness in some of these phrases, flag independence, or, you know, this idea, you can have your postage stamp. but XYZ. I mean, you know, for people like my grandparents, the postage stamp was a big deal. You know, no more King George or whatever. You know, now we've got Gandhi, and this is a big deal for them. Names. In Delhi, for instance, all the statues of the colonialists were removed and moved to a graveyard just outside near Karol Bagh. It's a huge thing for people. But there was a compromise that led to constrained sovereignty. Absolutely. Without a doubt. And in a sense, in this new phase, we're getting an attempt again. It's not the first attempt. You know, the whole Bandung project, the whole project of, you know, non-alignment, that whole project was trying to use the US and the Soviets against each other to get a good deal, get a steel factory, have a dam, the Aswan Dam, and so on. You know, we've been through this in a kind of zigzag way. It's not like, wow, for the first time, people are saying, let's have real sovereignty. Come on. This has been a struggle, a long struggle, long period of time. A lot of people lost their lives. Already we've named Lumumba, we've named Sankara, but I mean, there's, you know, Allende can be named 50 years of the coup. Lots of struggle on this one issue of trying to establish full sovereignty. Now, can it succeed? I don't know. What I do know is that the world is changing now. Now, with the emergence of these other powers, India, Brazil, to some extent, South Africa, China, and so on, the emergence of these new powers has allowed countries to have choices. Now, they're not perfect choices. We're not talking about choice between capitalism and socialism, okay? We're talking about a choice between a debt austerity IMF agenda and investment for infrastructure. That's what the BRICS project is promising for people. That's the Chinese Belt and Road. We'll invest, you build infrastructure. That's it. We're not talking about some grand fork in the road. Here's the capitalist barbarism of Rosa Luxemburg, and here's socialism. We're nowhere near there. What we are is at a fork in the road between the debt austerity pathway and the path for financing for infrastructure. That's what countries are given a choice for. I find it very silly when people debate, you know, well, you know, the BRICS thing is not socialist. Who said it's socialist? It's not socialist. But they are not the debt austerity IMF either. They are saying investment for infrastructure. And why? For gain. Obviously, people are gaining. It's not that they are a big charity organization. But you have two different gain projects. One project gain, where there's no benefit at all to the country that is taking the loan. That's the debt austerity project, where you're taking loans to pay off the interest of a previous loan. That's the IMF model. That's what Argentina has been eclipsed by. Second, you're saying, take a loan. We're not going to let you take this loan to pay off the debt. This loan is to build infrastructure. You need infrastructure in order for us to be able to have access to XYZ. But that's the nature of a slightly beneficial deal. Now, what countries are going to choose is up to them, but at least they have a choice.
Steve Biko, the South African freedom fighter who was assassinated by the apartheid regime, said, I'm quoting, "The most powerful tool in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed." How to break away from the colonial mentality of subordination?
Well, you know, I often say that political change is in a way pretty easy. You know, you can change a government. You can do it by the ballot box. Salvador Allende, after many, many tries, you can do a coup as the people in Niger. Political change. Economic change is harder, but you can do it. You know, you can find a way to access resources. You can change the land relations, conduct land reform, and so on. Then social change is harder still. You know, you have to create, say, creches so that women can go to university. They're not at home with their children because you've created a nursery, a social nursery. You create pension schemes. You create retirement policies. People can enjoy. That changes social life. Grandparents now can be grandparents, not just old people who have to work forever. You know, this changes society. The most difficult change, David, is cultural change. That, to me, is the most difficult change. And we don't spend enough time on it. Changing culture is hard. And there, the realm of ideas is very much in there. So, for instance, we're talking about decolonization. The idea of inferiority is so deeply in people's head through generation upon generation of the development of a culture. And even if people don't have the sense of inferiority, they have resentment against other people thinking they are inferior. This creates its own psychological traumas and problems. It's a big struggle. There is no key, golden key, you know, Willy Wonka's golden envelope to the chocolate. You open it and you win a prize. I wish you could just turn culture with a key, you know, make the culture change. It's a big struggle. Look at the question of patriarchy in South Asia, okay? I mean, all the South Asian countries have had women as heads of government and have had heads of state. Sri Lanka had a woman head of government in the 1950s, you know, Bandaranaike. She was there, I think, in the late 50s or maybe early 60s. Bandaranaike was there before many countries in the West had, you know, even 20% of women in parliaments and so on. But yet, the tap root of patriarchy is so deep in South Asia. You know, still you can go into educated people's homes and so on, and the men are there in the living room and the women are, you know. I mean, this is a very big struggle, and it is deep in our heads, you know, deep, deep in our heads. So I don't want to underestimate this and say it goes. What I do detect in the world today is a mood. Naledi Pandor, Foreign Minister of South Africa, was at a press conference standing beside previously mentioned Antony Blinken, the mediocrity of the Biden administration. And she said, we no longer want to be bullied. She used the word bullied in front of the U.S. State Department secretary. I thought that signifies something. When the Indian foreign minister, when he was told that in the U.S. people are saying, well, India can be part of NATO plus. And what Jai Shankar said was interesting to me. He said, that's interesting. But he said, we don't want to participate in the NATO mindset, in the NATO template. That was the expression he used, the NATO template. Bullied, NATO template, not interested in. It's a new mood. Now, will this carry over? Is it deep? Is it shallow? Is it just about, you know, jockeying for momentary interest right now, economic interests and so on? Has it any depth? Will it impact the culture of India, for instance, or the culture of South Africa? I don't know. But I do know that we are at some kind of inflection point. I often tell people, David, that we're not in a new period. We're exiting the period when the United States had dominance in the world. But we're not in a period right now. We are in a sandstorm. We are in a period between periods. Things are not clear. So when you hear these kind of statements, it's wrong to assemble them all and say, well, now we are in a multipolar era or we're in this or that. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres released a report recently, The New Agenda for Peace, in which he said people are calling this the era of multipolarity. But he did say that the post-Cold War era is over. You know, this era from 91 till recently when the US was in dominance. I agree with him. That period is over. I don't believe we're in a new period. I think we're in a period between periods. And those are always interesting because you're not sure what exactly is going on. And people who think they know everything, I'm not sure they are the most believable people.
Yeah. Our topic is Africa, from neoliberalism to independence. Where do you see the cracks in that neoliberal economic structure, which is so dominant?
Well, firstly, those cracks are not there in central banks. Those cracks are not there in economics departments in Makerere University, in, you know, the University of Witwatersrand, in the University of Tanzania, Dar es Salaam. This is not where, in these spaces, central banks, economics departments, we are not seeing the cracks there, David, not yet. There, we are seeing people persisting with the orthodoxy of neoliberalism. You know, people who become finance ministers in most of the countries in the global south persist. Look at Lula. Lula is sitting in Brazil in a cage match struggle with the central bank of Brazil over interest rates because the central bank is controlled by neoliberals. Look at China. You think the Chinese banks, People's Bank of China, are controlled by socialists? Not a chance. neoliberals. They have it in their grip. Generations and generations of neoliberals, so many of them trained at Stanford University, you know, economics departments, Wharton School of Business, and so on and so forth. This project, you know, what we called the Chicago Boys Project in Chile, when Milton Friedman, even Friedrich Hayek traveled to Chicago, to Chile during the coup years. These gurus of neoliberalism, you know, sent their boys, Chileans, who were brought to Chicago to train. Well, it's not the Chicago Boys, no, it's a Stanford economist, Chicago, blah, blah, blah. But they're everywhere. And there's no crack yet. They are still religious about their convictions about privatization and so on, despite the fact that reality has gone against them. Now, you asked, where are the cracks? The cracks are there, I think, to some extent, amongst the business crowd. Why do I say that? You know, I look pretty regularly at Credit Suisse, their global assessment, at Goldman Sachs, global assessment. BlackRock has an excellent global assessment. They have high quality researchers working for them to analyze moves in the global economy. And all these major people who manage money basically are anxious that this strategy of privatization and finance capital is just not going to build the dividends that they need. That you do need to re-enter the quote-unquote real economy, make investments, build things, grow things, you know, sell things and so on. You can't just be selling, buying and selling money. Something deeper needs to happen. And that hesitancy inside the upper ends of people who have to deal with real money, you know, because they are dealing with trillions of dollars, which they have to invest in. Even though they have the advantages of scale, they can see the problems. I occasionally talk to people in that world, try to discuss with them how they understand, let's say, the Basel project. You know, in Basel, there are these rules that keep getting written for regulation of banks and so on about leveraging and the amount of reserves they need to hold. Anyway, so those conversations, that's where you see reality. And where else do you see reality? Among the billions of people in the world. That's the real problem here facing many countries. You know, years ago, when I was writing The Poorer Nations, which is about the period after the collapse of the Third World, I found an excellent quotation from the president of the Bank of America. And what the president of the Bank of America said in the early 1980s was, he said, look, we can't kill the patient. What he meant was the working people of the planet. Got to keep them alive. And he said that if you press them too hard, they'll die or they'll revolt. We have to go only so far before they die or they revolt. You know, he was not in favor of mass extinction of the planet, nor was he in favor of revolution. Anything short of extinction and revolution, acceptable. I think we are here now. That's why there's anxiety among upper-level bankers and people who manage, you know, the world at that level. They see the problem. You know, you have levels of hunger, inequality so high that people like the Bidens and so on have no answer to these questions. They're unable to engage them. When they call African leaders to Washington, D.C., they don't know what to talk to them about. You know, here are governments facing situation, 50% of the population under poverty line, a large number of people hungry, no relief on debt, no relief on fuel prices. And you have nothing to say to them, because the only thing you can say is, you know, keep your money sound, privatize and so on. In Argentina, there was a pre-election for the presidency. A far-right-wing candidate won 1 in 3 Argentines votes. Okay, he won 1 in 3. Far right wing guy. Okay, he also, by the way, used to be a tantric sex instructor. Just for your David, you may be interested in that. But what's fascinating about his agenda is he went to the people of Argentina and he said, "What you need to make our economy grow is extreme austerity. We are going to have extreme austerity." And 1 in 3 Argentines voted for him. We're in a very strange situation in the world where people know there is no hope for them through austerity, debt, and so on. There's no hope for them. Inflation is out of control. At the same time, you can get megalomaniac politicians going out there and saying, I'm going to hit you harder in order to restart the economy. People are saying, okay, let's give that a try. That's why, David, we are in a period between periods.
Well, fueling that anxiety, that sense of angst, has got to be the looming climate catastrophe. It's right in front of us. It's going to hit the global south the hardest.
Well, you know, I was really very paralyzed watching the scenes from Canada. There have been 600 wildfires in Canada. Temperatures up to 42, 43 degrees Celsius. Tokyo, Japan, had a sustained, what the World Meteorological Organization called prolonged heat wave. And then Hawaii, you know, the destruction in Hawaii, already plans to build new hotels and so on. You know, destruction as mass gentrification, scandalous. Well, the World Meteorological Organization, in the middle of all these wildfires around the Pacific, released a really chilling report, David, called State of the Climate in Southwest Pacific 2022. I found this chilling because they talked about how, as a consequence of ocean warming, not just sea level rise, but, well, they are related, because as the ocean warms, the sea rises, not only because of the melting of the ice caps, but also warm water takes up more volume and so on. Anyway, if you read the World Meteorological Organization report, State of the Climate in the South Pacific, it shows you the level of destruction of coral reefs, therefore marine animal extinction and so on. It is ghastly to read that. And no movement on it. Not even much interest about it. You know, again, in Hawaii, the first thing they talk about is rebuilding. And then again, it's all this stuff about tourism. What about stopping for a minute and saying, wait a minute, it's not just Hawaii. There's wildfires in Canada, wildfires in Hawaii. You know, you put this thing together and all the experts are telling you this is terrible. You know, now, I also don't go in the catastrophism direction that in 5 years the planet is going to burn up and die. I think it's not exactly that. But for a lot of people, it's already burning up and dying. Okay, so they're not waiting. They're seeing it happen now. So I feel like there's something here that reflects the callousness again in culture, the sense that we can wait it out. You know, if we are in a safe place, we can wait it out. I'm sorry for the others that they are going to suffer, but we can wait it out. A sense of compassion and solidarity as a people on the planet is really diminished, in my opinion. You know, people are sad about Hawaii and then they forget about it.
So, you know, we've talked quite a bit about Africa. Why should people here, I'm in Boulder, Colorado, you're in Santiago, Chile, why should people here care about what's going on there?
That's an interesting question. Firstly, people should learn to care about everywhere, because in my opinion, the planet is now so intertwined. The question of the climate environment intertwines us. The question of the global economy and the commodity chain intertwines us. I mean, you know, you and I are talking via Zoom. We are using, both of us, computers. Many of the components in what unites you and me are from Africa and Latin America and then assembled in Asia. You know, for instance, the copper wire may come from Zambia or from Chile. I don't know. There are all kinds of rare earth metals in our screens that likely come from the Congo. We are already, you and I, part of a global story that includes the African continent and Latin America and Asia and, you know, everybody. I mean, that's the second reason why we're already united. But thirdly, politically. Look, you know, the West has done a great job destabilizing countries on the African continent, such as in the Sahel. Now these countries are standing up. Solidarity to them is really important. I think people are quite confused. They say, how can we defend a coup? You know, because they are thinking again, David, about, let's say, the coup in Chile against Allende, saying, look, you are against Pinochet's coup. How can you be in favor? You should be for democracy. I agree. On principle, that's true. But we don't live in a world of principles. We live in a world of contradictions. And therefore, got to understand the contradictory situation in which people find themselves. Also, you have to understand an act of solidarity against, say, Western intervention into Niger should be very much axiomatic. But even more, you see, it should be clear that ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, is not intervening on their own behalf alone. They are intervening on behalf of the French. The French are eager to Rwandaize the conflict, as they did in Mozambique, where they had Rwanda intervene in Cabo Delgado instead of French forces go directly. This quote-unquote Africanization of imperialist maneuvers in the continent is now very clear for people to see. Why should people care about somewhere as far away as Niger? Because it's not that far away from you.
Thanks very much for your time. You were just listening to Vijay Prashad on Africa, from neoliberalism to independence. I spoke to him in mid-August. Vijay Prashad is an internationally renowned historian and journalist. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Medea Benjamin, Noam Chomsky, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Vijay Prashad on Africa from Neoliberalism to Independence, and for his book, Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Why did you interfere with attitude?
That's right.
It was just fine with gratitude. Were you searching for latitude? A good attitude don't need no help from flatitude. The good is enough. Any more would be rough and confusing to me. Keep it simple. A good persona will win. Oh, how it makes you grin. A smile that goes from side to side. Don't need no interference. It's already a lovely appearance. It shows you followed the right guide. Get back, flatitude. Can't use you in my attitude. It's just a fake. And it just won't make you look that good. Nothing to say that would make any sense. Oh, it's just downright dense. Just keep it simple.
Donations to the War Amps have a lasting impact on amputees. Today, your support gives them the artificial limbs needed for everyday activities. This helps them prepare for tomorrow on their road to independence. To learn how your donation helps, visit waramps.ca.
You are now listening to
CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Our cabinet minister should be